Hello, everyone, and welcome back to our podcast on program evaluation and public policy evaluation. This is Jenny, glad to be joining you again, and today we're going to be talking through the first kind of section in our textbook, which gives us the how-to, as in how to do an evaluation. Our conversation today is going to cover chapters 4 through 6. Chapter 4 on evaluation ideologies and approaches, chapter 5 on understanding the program, also called Define Part 1, and chapter 6, Define Part 2 on modeling the program. Chapter 6 will be in particular quite important as it connects back to the use of logic models, which is a mandatory assignment for this course and for your final policy analysis project. So please do tune in and pay attention to that chapter. I will be using this podcast to again supplement the slides for this section. So if you can, please go ahead and navigate to the Canvas website for the course. We are going to be looking at the module on evaluation approaches and understanding and modeling programs. This could be week 2 or it could be section 2, depending on if you are taking this as a 5-week class or during the regular semester. Once you are on that roadmap page for ideologies, approaches, and methods, you will scroll down to the slides to accompany this week's reading, open slides to accompany chapters 4 through 6, and let us begin. Our objectives with this podcast episode: highlight those main points from chapters 4 through 6, similar to what we did with our first episode and the focus on chapters 1 through 3. I want to, in addition to that, give some more explanations to cover concepts and topics. In particular, I want to talk us a little bit more through things like calibrators and, again, through the components of a logic model, because the terms are easy to say and much more difficult to truly understand. Then I want to wrap with a little more guidance on the upcoming assignments and, in particular, our midterm exam. If you are someone who has not had an exam with me before, you will probably see the structure as a little bit unique. If you've had classes with me before, there will be nothing different about this exam. Although, again, I will always say take the time to read the instructions, even if you feel very familiar, just so that we are all on the same page. Let's get rolling right into chapter 4. Evaluation ideologies and approaches. Okay, lots of big loaded terms here. Let's begin looking at slide 4, defining what falls under ideology. Okay, there are a couple of big terms. Right out the gate, we get the term ideology, and ideology here is defined as basically a way that we think about issues or the world. The book defines it as a system of beliefs we use to explain and develop solutions, or a philosophy or a way of thinking about a certain topic or issue. I mean, in general, ideology is pretty vague as a concept, but under ideology are going to fall a couple of things that are going to be affected by the way we think about stuff. One of those things will be methods, the research methods that we actually use to investigate and study a public policy or a program. And then the approach. Those approaches, really, that's such a vague, not really well-defined term. And when we talk about approach, we're going to say the design of our evaluation. So we're going to be encountering here something called calibrators, design calibrators, role calibrators, methods calibrators. These are all going to be a general part of our evaluation ideology and approach. And don't get too hung up on things like the terms ideology and approach. That's actually less important for you to understand than to be thinking about things like the different types of calibrators as well as the different types of designs that we can use in any evaluation. So general thoughts, ideology captures, or what falls under ideology will include things like methods and approaches. Just work through the chapter as best you can with the terms, and then let me really kind of break down here for you the conversation about calibrators. First and foremost in this conversation about calibrators, calibrators is a bit of a weird term to use here because essentially what we're doing is looking at alternatives or options or this continuum in the way that we approach an evaluation. So we're in section 4.2 of the chapter. I want you to go right to 4.2.1 called the design calibrators. So the design calibrators are captured on slides 6 and 7. And really what this means is, what is the research method or design of your research that you're going to use in your evaluation? And we can choose a couple of different designs, obviously. Those are going to be captured a bit more later in the chapter. But on the calibrator thing, what we're talking about is, are you going to use a model of research that is really hardcore experiment so that you can say for sure whatever you find in your evaluation is due to the factors that you've traced it out to? Now, experimental methods are really controlled environments. You usually have to be in a laboratory to investigate these. So if I'm doing an evaluation on something like a social security program, that's not really something I can do in an experiment because it's not in a controlled environment. If I wanted to do an evaluation on a certain type of, let's say, intervention with kids, where I'm gonna have kids in a specific situation or I'm gonna put them in a situation and then I'm going to introduce a response to that situation, I might be able to control that in a lab setting. And in that case, my design structure calibrator might lean more towards the experimental method where I'm controlling for a bunch of things and saying, okay, it's definitely this specific action that is affecting the kids or not affecting the kids in this situation. Or again, if I'm choosing to do something that's, let's say, more of a social security investigation, or I'm looking at policy in the real world, I'm going to lean probably more toward what is called the anthropological model of research. We've got the medical model on the far end by experiments, and the anthropological model on the other far end by observation without intervention. Usually, when we're talking about public policy, we're going to be observing something. We're not going to usually be able to do an experiment where we truly control the whole setting. We might be able to do a quasi-experimental design. But I'm going to say from prior experience as an evaluator, if you're doing public policy and program evaluation, generally speaking, you're looking at a quasi-experimental design, observation with intervention or observation without intervention. That means you're going to look at it. You're going to try and understand and study it without intervening in it if you're at the far end without intervention, or it might be observation with intervention where you look at what's going on in a program and you perhaps pause it to help the program creators do something better or more effectively, more efficiently. You might jump in to help out, okay? Medical model, very, very controlled environment. This is a lot of like hard sciences, chemistry, biology. That stuff definitely lends itself well to a medical model. Public policy is more towards the we can't control everything end of things. So on your design structure calibrator, you got to decide how controlled, you got to decide, that is, how controlled is your setting, how controlled is your evaluation, versus how much is it just kind of observing the real world. And again, we can't really find ourselves, or don't really find ourselves all that often in a true experimental setting. So we usually have to go with a structure that's more quasi-experimental or observation-based. That takes us through design structure. But that doesn't tell us perhaps what is our purpose for this evaluation design. Are you, as the evaluator, someone who is totally hands-off, and I'm not here to make changes to whatever I'm observing? Or perhaps you've been given a different role where you're supposed to help whatever is happening with this public policy or with this program work better. I've actually been in both situations as an evaluator. In one evaluation I did of an educational program, I was completely hands-off and just looking at the data that the program sent me or the information that the program passed along to me. And I was doing the pure program, no changes necessarily. I was just giving them feedback on how well they were doing. And I did not have a role where I was trying to make changes. I could suggest things, but I wasn't looking to really shape the program. This might be something you do in a more of a summative evaluation where the program's already ended. You can't really make changes at that point in time because it's already over. So you're going to be stepping back and looking at the no changes type of approach. But an evaluation I was involved in here in Nebraska was one that asked me to play a role in terms of, okay, we want to improve the program. What suggestions do you have based on what you've seen so far? That is definitely more of a developmental type evaluation or a formative evaluation where, again, the folks who are running it are asking for your input and saying, look, we want you to help make changes, to suggest changes. Maybe you play a more active role. And so our design purpose here, if you are staying fully hands off and you're just kind of letting the program exist separate from you, you might be at that pure program, no changes end. If you are being asked to play a more active role, to be an evaluator who's involved in trying to improve something, you're going to be closer to the continuous program improvement model. And again, that's largely going to depend on when they pull you into evaluation. So if something's already done, you can't make changes, although you could suggest some changes for the future if they do the program again. If it's continuous improvement, they're probably going to want you to be very involved and to not just make recommendations, but maybe even develop tools to help them make those changes and to improve the outcomes or the benefits to the people who are in the program. That is the design calibrators. There's two of those. There's going to be two calibrators for each of the three areas. We started with design, and now we're going to do evaluator involvement. And this is going to sound in some ways very similar to the design purpose, okay? Design purpose with the pure program, no changes, and continuous program improvement is also going to involve how much are you stepping in and being part of it. If you are what is known as an external evaluator, you are generally not part of the program. You're not somebody that they've hired. You're not sitting down at meetings with the people who are doing the work necessarily. And you're being really hands-off. So I'm going to look at the research. I'm going to write up my report. I'm going to give you what I figure out that you've done or you haven't done or the way that the plan worked or didn't work. I'm just observing. Again, I'm not necessarily doing anything, certainly while the program is going on. I might be giving thoughts in my report, but I'm not really super collaborative with the people involved in the program. On the other end, you are hands-on and you are all in as an evaluator. Again, as part of the evaluation role, you may be asked to give that kind of input, to give your insight, to tell people what you've learned and how you think they can do better. So hands off, separate from the program, I'm really not in the same space as all the people who are doing the work, whereas hands on, I'm going to be more of a partner. I'm more involved, I'm more collaborative, I might create tools, I might give suggestions, I might even do follow-up on my suggestions to see how people are doing that. External evaluators generally means you're pretty hands-off, you're not involved. Internal evaluators are usually more hands-on. Okay, evaluator responsibility. Again, these are all going to kind of mishmash or run over one another. The boundaries are not neat and clean. It's more of a, we got to kind of figure out where we generally land. So on the responsibility side, again, it's, do I have a large role to play in this program or in this policy? Am I responsible for helping them to continue the work, to improve the work, or am I just here to give them what my input is in probably something like a true report, and then I leave? I'm not going to hang around and help work on whatever they're developing. So if I'm an external evaluator, and again, in my experience, when I did this with educational programs, it was once a year, I would get the information from the people who were running the program. In this case, they were developing a STEM program for science, technology, and really it was science and technology focused. So how well did they do with that STEM program? It's in another state. I don't go do any visits with them. I don't have phone calls. I just get the information from the program director. I read through it, and then I prepare my report that says, on these goals, you're doing this well. Or here's how you've improved from year one to year three. Very much a report and leave, except I didn't even have to leave because I was not in the same state as the educational program. On the flip side of that, you can be an evaluator who, again, isn't just there to tell them what's going on, but to help them do better. So, am I, quote unquote, building internal capacity? Am I basically helping the people doing the work to do the work better, right? That would be building internal capacity. I worked in a prior position for the criminal justice system here in the state of Nebraska, specifically the Board of Parole. If I'm working there and I'm evaluating something there, I'm also going to be responsible for helping parole officers do their jobs better. Or perhaps if I take it from a completely different setting, let's say I'm consulting with a company where we have a big problem with communication between the leadership and the people who do the day-to-day stuff. Again, another actual situation where I was called in as a consultant to say, okay, here's where I see the gaps between the people who are in charge and the people who are not in charge. And a bit of what was expected was to help the people in charge learn how to communicate better, right? That's actually capacity building. I'm building the skills of the people I'm helping to evaluate. So that's the difference between building internal capacity and report and leave. And I will say, in the field, more and more, we are finding that we generally want evaluators to help a little bit on that internal capacity building, right? So you're trying to help people with their skills, or at least you're trying to identify the skills where more work is needed. True report and leave evaluations are pretty limited, and I haven't had that much involvement in them in my career. Again, there's quite a few where you definitely give a report, but you don't usually just leave. The only time I've encountered that was when I was evaluating, again, a STEM program from another state. And it was kind of a checking the box activity, so to speak, because what they had was a federal grant and they were needing to submit reports as part of their grant requirements. And so I helped them fulfill that little bit of what they needed to do to keep getting the money. Okay, our last two calibrators kind of fall under methods. Now, they've called one data collection and they've called the other the methods focus, but it's all going to be tied into your methods, because data collection is going to be, well, how do you get your information and what information are you looking for? We can be looking at quantitative data, which is numbers, right? We can do surveys and get lots of surveys and count the surveys. We can do large-scale analysis of like existing research that's out there. So if I want to do that research on Social Security, I might get reports from the Social Security Administration and crunch the numbers and run some statistics to give them information. That would be more of the quantitative large volume analysis. But I could also choose doing a qualitative or high detail analysis. Well, something more like interviews, where I sit down and talk with someone and I try to get a really strong and, again, detailed sense of the program or whatever the policy is. So let's use the example of immigration policy, remain in Mexico. I could do a quantitative large volume analysis where I simply look at how many people and how many deportations, how many courtroom interactions, how many basically individuals stayed in Mexico and followed through the process, how many didn't. It's really about the numbers. Versus doing a qualitative assessment or qualitative evaluation of the program where I'd probably talk to lots of different people involved. I might talk to individuals who work with immigration and customs enforcement who had to do the actual enforcement in person to find out what their experience was and how it affected them. I would talk to people who worked in immigration courts to find out how the policy worked for them. I would probably talk to people who went through the entire process if I can find them and easily talk to them. And that would be a very qualitative approach because I would be talking through their experiences to get a quote-unquote richer sense of how the program worked in real life for most people. Again, you're kind of it's a balancing act. Any calibrator is deciding I'm closer to one end or the other. And for a particular reason, because either I want to share most of the numbers and talk about the outcomes, and that's what my people are really interested in with my evaluation, or maybe I want to describe what's happening because perhaps people don't know exactly what's happening, and that's going to be more helpful for them in terms of understanding what's getting done and what is not. The final calibrator is this methods focus, and focus is another generic term where we're trying to balance between like objectives oriented or goal free evaluation. So are we looking specifically at the program wants to do, what it says it's going to do, or do we get a little bit more free ranging in that? And maybe we look at the things that they didn't intend to happen. So perhaps remain in Mexico. Let's use that example again. If I'm focused only on the objectives of the program, generally speaking, one could assume that that program was intended to reduce illegal immigration numbers. So I'd look at that. What were the numbers? Did it reduce the illegal immigration? Did it change perhaps the time that it took to get people through the process? Did it reduce the number of people even involved in the process? Because that is going to be tied to the goals of the program. They want people to follow the process to reduce illegal migration numbers. How does that actually look in reality? A goal-free evaluation would probably say, okay, those are the intended consequences. What are the unintended consequences? So did this change the way that perhaps ICE officers saw their jobs? Did it have really negative or positive effects for them? Because that may not have been a goal, but it could have been something that does happen as a result of the policy. Maybe it changed the way that Congress approached the issue. That would not have been an intended consequence necessarily, but it could be something that happens as a result. So objectives oriented is really saying we're going to focus on what they said they wanted to do and how they said they were going to do it. And goal-free evaluation is going to say, yep, we're going to look at that, but we're also going to think bigger picture. How did it affect other things? How did it change other dynamics in the real world? At least with respect to, again, how the program affected that. We're not totally losing sight of the program or the policy here. We're still keeping that in mind, but we are going to look at things that maybe people didn't think about that could have come as a result of putting this into place. That is probably the most critical part that you need to understand from Chapter 4. I do think when you get to Section 4.4, we're doing different types of evaluation approach, going back to that objectives-oriented, goal-free, or theory-based. That's all going to be important for you to understand. So do, when you're starting in Section 4.4, around page 91 and continuing through, looking at it right now, I'm going to say approximately page 95, make sure you understand those terms. Again, the terms are going to be defined in the margins of the page on the right or left-hand side. Get those terms down. Make sure you understand them. Those are actually going to be relevant for you in coming up with your evaluation plan, because you're going to need to identify in your final project what type of evaluation you're using. Is it embedded? Is it objectives oriented? Is it a CIPP evaluation? Which, go back to the book, make sure you understand what that stands for. Those are all going to be important terms, so make sure you know the definition and explanation of them. All right, that is going to wrap my discussion of the key elements of Chapter 4. So let's move on to Chapter 5, which is called Understanding the Program. Now, Chapter 5 is going to talk a fair bit about embedded evaluation at the beginning. That's fine and great. Embedded evaluation is one approach. It's not necessarily the majority approach. It's definitely what our author is saying would be a good approach for evaluation. So I'm going to say read through it, of course, but go ahead and focus more initially, I would say, on Section 5.2. Because what Section 5.2 is truly understanding the program. And then to understand a program in an evaluation, you have to really explain what it is, okay? You're describing it. Let's say you have someone who's never seen this, never heard of this. What basic elements would you need to tell them in order to give them a sense of what's done without necessarily burying them in a ton of reading? Chapter 5 is really important when we talk about what's called the program narrative, okay? A program narrative is going to give that general description, things like what is the program's design, what is its structure, what are its goals? And that's big part of, well, not a huge part really, not really a big part, but it's a part of what you will need to do with your project. So let's say the program you've chosen has something to do with education. A number of individuals in this class have talked about educational elements like teacher recruitment or using a specific program within a school, right? We could go crazy and get into the realm of, hey, let's talk about how we teach sex education in schools. You know, little bit of a spicy topic, let's say. You're going to need to describe what goes into that sex education program. Who designs it? What is the setup of the group that runs it? Is this something within the school? Is it something that the school brings in from the outside? What is the structure of the organization that's teaching it? And then what are the goals for that sex education program? Is this an abstinence-only sex education program? Is it something that goes beyond that and teaches maybe about sexually transmitted diseases or general safe sex practices? Is it something that goes further than that, where we're getting much more in detail about health and sex education that would be, again, maybe more than what you'd encounter in a more limited sex education program? I'm using sex education just because it's one of those firestorms when you get into school settings, and it's kind of easy to wrap our brains around to think about a program narrative with things like goals and how it works. And then again, what to expect. You're going to talk about the program. You're going to talk about how do they do what they do. They go into a classroom and they teach, or do they use like an online system so that students work through modules? How do they do the work? And that is a program narrative. That will be all you really need to capture for your project. Section 5.4 in this chapter goes into what is called the program theory. And a program theory might also be called something like a theory of change, or a TOC. Program theory and theory of change should explain a lot of what happens and how we get to the results that we do, right? I would say, for the purposes of this class, understand program theory and theory of change, but I would not worry yourself too much about, again, theory of change in relation to your project. partially because we're going to do that work, but we're going to call it a logic model, which is what takes us into chapter 6. Just as a quick note before I move into that discussion of chapter 6, I want to make clear I use an example, again, from an evaluation I've actually done. It was for a program called Operation Youth Success, and I've given that example on slide 16, which is intending to give you a theory of change example. So what I wrote there is with Operation Youth Success, the theory of change is that problems like disproportionate minority contact can be reduced by bringing together groups of stakeholders, and that through information sharing and training, we can change behaviors that may increase that contact. Now, disproportionate minority contact refers to how we tend to take more children of color, Black children, Hispanic children, mixed race children, and they tend to appear in the criminal justice system at rates higher than they appear in the general population. And this was something that we investigated in Douglas County because Douglas County, when they hired me, had brought this data to me and showed me, okay, so here's the proportion of children who identify by these different racial classifications, and here's who's actually in our criminal justice system. And the numbers were pretty way off, like way off. So going from, let's say, 15% of the population to 60% of the population when you get into the criminal justice system for individuals who identify as Black, that's disproportionate contact because they're only 15% of the population, but they appear to be 60% of the population by the time we get to the prisons. That would be disproportionate minority contact. And it would show up in other parts of the system. So how many kids end up referred to, let's say, the county attorney for things like running away or being truant? How many kids end up arrested by the police for different offenses that they might commit? That's all part of the larger conversation for Operation Youth Success. And their whole point was to say, we think people will change their behaviors because we're going to share information with them and we're going to train them. And that will get us to the point of reducing this disproportionate minority contact. At least that was their theory of change. So I wanted to give that suggestion, or at least that example, to illustrate what theory of change means, at least using that specific context. Finally, let's get into chapter 6 and the concept of logic modeling. I have one slide 17, in here about the terminology in relation to logic models. I'm going to come back to that, but I wanted to talk with you about what a logic model is and how we essentially develop them. So a logic model is a visual, graphical presentation of what's called the program's theory. It's really not that hard to conceptualize. A theory is just an explanation of something, right? Like, that's what we need to start with. So this is a program's explanation of what they do, how they do it, and what they expect to happen as a result of doing that work, all right? So a logic model, again, a picture. You're putting a picture in front of someone. It's kind of like an infographic, not as usually pretty as an infographic is, but it's a diagram or a process. It's just a chart version of an explanation of what happens, okay? So we have to start in a logic model with something like a situation or a problem, and then what are we gonna do, right? A logic model on the left-hand side is going to have, again, usually the problem, and then it's going to talk about the goals that the program has or the policy has for dealing with that problem. So if I use Operation Youth Success in it again, disproportionate minority contact is the problem, according to them. So the goal, to reduce that, we want not so many children who are identifying as a minority to be so much more prominent in the criminal justice system. We want the numbers to be relatively consistent with how they appear in the population. So if the population is 50% white, it should be 50% white when we get to kids in custody, right? Like kids who are actually being put in the equivalent of a jail or a prison, which we don't have very much of anymore. But if that was the case, that would be proportionate contact. That's the goal, is to get more proportionate. The moving from the left to the right of a logic model, you then have what are called inputs. And inputs are the things that we are going to have and use to address the problem. So Operation Youth Success had people that they hired, their staff. That's part of the inputs. They had money that they were given. So that money is part of their inputs. They had networks of different people that they worked with. So collaborators or friends or different entities who were coming and helping work on the project. So in Douglas County, that included like Omaha Police Department. So we were working like our networks or our collaborations with the Omaha Police Department would be part of our inputs. All of the things that we have and can contribute to resolving the problem are things that would be our inputs. Our outputs are the things that we do on some level. What we do in terms of particular activities, who we are working with, or maybe the things that we develop, the products that we create. So with Operation Youth Success, they did a lot of meetings. They created reports. They worked with different groups across the state. These are all of their outputs, their activities, their products, and their participation. This can be a little bit difficult sometimes to develop in terms of your logic model, but it's going to be anything and everything that they do, and that's going to fall under activities, and it should be activities like conducting a meeting or having a conference. And then products are things that like you could tangibly hold in your hand or let's say look at online. So any reports would be a product. Anything like a website would be a product. Because again, it's something that you've created that is a resource for someone else. And then the participation is again, like who are you engaged with? That could be the kids involved in the criminal justice system. It can be the people who create programs for kids to help them stay out of the system or to help them manage their time in the system. That would be anybody working within the juvenile criminal justice system. Okay, those might be our participation or who we reach elements, especially if we're thinking about training people to address behaviors or issues that we think might be contributing to having disproportionate minority contact. The last segment of a logic model on the right-hand side is going to be outcomes. And outcomes are going to be split between short-term outcomes, medium or intermediate outcomes, and long-term outcomes. Short-term outcomes are really the things that happen truly in the short term. So after I've done a meeting with a group, the short-term thing is they've probably, at least hopefully, learned something from the meeting, right? Short-term outcomes are usually learning because we can do that in the immediate sense. It's something we can grasp right away. Intermediate or medium-term outcomes are usually about behaviors. So how did we change the way we acted or the way we interacted or what we did? That's a little bit more intermediate because while you can learn right away, generally when we change our behaviors, we have to adapt something. We have to use a different process. We may have to modify something in addition to just changing our behavior that helps us support that. And then long term is really what we expect about our conditions or the society around us that we think is going to happen as a result of the larger program. So disproportionate minority contact, if we do all these trainings and all these people learn these things and they change their behavior, the long-term outcome we're hoping to see is less disproportionate minority contact, right? That's our goal. long-term is usually going to go right back to that bigger goal that folks have. But we could have other long-term outcomes, like maybe because of the work that we do, school systems call the cops less on students. That might be something that happens. It's a long-term outcome because it's not an individual level behavior. It's that the schools are changing their general approach. Again, these are all meant to be examples to kind of help you put together these different parts of what a logic model is, okay? And I do want you to go back to the Canvas site. Make sure that you are looking at the additional resources for this segment of the course. I've got my Operation Youth Success example logic model there, and that's one I've developed. But there's the St. Louis CHAAP model. There's the Community Toolbox, which is helping to develop one. Or there's another link that's about enhancing program performance with logic models. Your textbook also includes examples of logic models. Now, one of those examples or some of those examples are going to be in the chapter closer to the end. And then some additional examples are in the very end or back section of the book where they're kind of walking through all of the different tools that go into the evaluation process. So please do take the time to look through those examples. And when you're running into something that doesn't make sense, please, please, please let me know. And this is one of those things you get to actually practice in this course. We have two assignments tied into what comes out of Chapter 6, the Logic Model Practice Quiz, which is mostly about the words and the terms and how well you understand them. You have two attempts at that quiz. It's not a huge amount of points, but I would encourage you to take your time with it because sometimes we hear the word output and it's easy to confuse with outcome. And what are the differences between these things? And then the logic model practice itself is you taking the program or the policy that you're investigating for your project and doing the logic model for that. So if I'm doing the logic model on, let's say, the foster care program, I got to pick out a specific foster care program and say, okay, who's involved in this program? How do they do the work they do? And what do they think is going to happen as a result of that foster care program? Or maybe it's a conservation program and farmers are participants. Who runs the program? What do they have to invest? They work with the farmers, but what do they do with the farmers? What products do they create? And then what are the outcomes? What did the people they worked with learn? What did the people they worked with do differently as far as behavior? What were the larger results in terms of conservation? This is really, again, applying the logic model tool to your specific policy or program. As you work through this, please, please always let me know what concerns or questions or clarification you need. I am more than happy to provide that to you. Just shoot me an email at jemille@wsc.edu, and I will get back to you as soon as I can. Okay, venture forth, check out these tools, see what you think, give me your questions, and I promise to connect again with you soon on all things evaluation. In the meantime, have a great day, week, weekend, and know that there is more to come in the future.